When Steve Jobs asks you to be his biographer, you say yes, right? Walter Isaacson turned him down twice.
You're a young guy, a whole career ahead of you. You'll do it in a couple of decades when you finally retire.
But finally, Isaacson decided he had to write the book that came out this week.
This guy stands right at the connection of creativity and technology, and he's fighting cancer, and he wants to talk. Of course I wanted to do it.
Later, we'll hear from Jessamyn Ward, whose new novel has just been nominated for a National Book Award. It's about a family on the Gulf Coast, set during Hurricane Katrina.
And I thought, well, what could I do with my life? That if I did die in like a month or a year or tomorrow or whenever, that I would feel like I'd lived a life worth living. I thought, writing, that's what I want to do.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by PBS, presenting The Fabric of the Cosmos, a new Nova series with physicist and author Brian Greene, starts Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with Jessamyn Ward, whose new novel was just named a National Book Award finalist. And the sometimes over-the-top performer Sandra Bernhard talks about her always over-the-top inspiration, Carol Channing.
She had this voice that, you know, was unparalleled by anybody else.
One of my own favorite songs from way back when. So...
That's ahead this hour, but first, every time a new Apple product is rumored or actually comes out, a fraction of the country goes into a frenzy. Every bit of new information is pored over by millions of Apple cultists. A new release is getting that kind of excitement right now, but it's an old-fashioned book, a huge tell-all biography of Steve Jobs. Jobs was known for being super secretive, but when he knew he was very ill, he gave the writer Walter Isaacson complete and total access. The book came out Monday, and it is already the number one bestseller on Amazon, and Walter Isaacson is here with me now. Walter, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be with you, Kurt.
So, you said no to Steve Jobs at first when he asked you to do this some years ago, and then you said no again.
Well, that makes it sound like I'm, denying Steve Jobs.
But you
did.
It was
a casual conversation in summer of 2004 in which he says, you know, you ought to write my biography. And I said to him, hey, you're a young guy. You've been a whole career ahead of you. We'll do it in a couple of decades when you finally retire. And it didn't quite occur to me that he had just been diagnosed with cancer. And he hadn't told me that. And so by the time I fully realized the seriousness of his cancer, and he had done, you know, by 2009 when we started talking seriously again, you know, the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, and totally transformed three more industries, I thought, boy, this guy stands right at the connection of creativity and technology, and he's fighting cancer, and he wants to talk. You know, of course I wanted to do it.
But the thing that shocked me the most, I think, about this book is what a jerk he was. I mean, what a cruel, callous, unkind person he was.
He was callous and unkind quite a bit. And I try to, I hope, also put that in perspective, which is, why is he that way? And, you know, his explanations are, you got to prevent the bozo explosion in company. Secondly, if you're brutally honest, you're going to get A players. He said, look, I'm sure in the Brahmin clubs there's a more velvet-gloved way of doing it. But people, I say, you know, who wear these velvet gloves often don't make a dent in the universe. And he said, and I'm not that person. This is who I am. You have to look at the result. Let me try to put it in context, and I hope the book does this. Professionally, he can be really rough on people or canonize them and put them on a pedestal. So what happens? In two different places, Pixar and Apple, he creates a team that not only is filled with A players, it's not what he says, you know, saturated with the bozo explosion, meaning mediocre players in the middle level. It's all A players. And more importantly, he pulls together a team at Apple and at Pixar who are phenomenally loyal. You could pick other companies where people run it with velvet gloves and people are always nice. They don't have right. people who stick around and are loyal.
Because it was in the service of the insanely great.
It was in the service of the insanely great. He was very charismatic. And let me even put it to the family then. When, you know, the end comes last month, a month or two ago, and it's, you know, he's very ill. All four of his children are there, right by his bedside all the time, totally adoring him. His wife, a faithful, you know, relationship for more than 20 years, she's there totally adoring him. His sister, Mona Simpson. So who am I to judge?
The net result at the pearly gates is, yeah, okay, yeah, more good than bad.
The net result at the pearly gates is he's a genius, and he was charismatic, and he sure rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, but in the end he created great products, a great team, and a great family, all of whom were insanely loyal to him.
One of the interesting motifs in this book that we learn that is implicit in knowing the products, but here you learn one learns the specifics of it, is his interest, his sort of self-taught, really, interest in design from the beginning. Yeah. At Reed College, he takes a calligraphy course, and that inspires his interest in typography, which makes the Macintosh typographical look what it was.
It starts when he's a little kid and he's growing up in a house, a housing suburb filled with these homes called Eichler homes, Joseph Eichler, E-I-C-H-L-E-R. And he made mass marketed homes that were sort of like Frank Lloyd Wright homes, but they were done inexpensively for the masses. But they had, you know, sort of big windows and extreme simplicity. And Steve Jobs appreciated the notion not only of great design, but taking great design and making it for the masses. Likewise, his father taught him when they built a fence around the backyard of that house, make sure the back of the fence is just as good looking as the front. Because even though nobody will see it, you will know. And you will know that you put as much care into the parts unseen as you did to the parts seen. Then, when he's first starting Apple, even in the garage, he goes to a little Sony, you know, showroom, and he's looking at the brochures and loves the industrial Sony style. And then he goes to the Aspen Design Conference in the late 1970s, and he realizes, and he gives a talk. I found a cassette tape of it in one of the archives there, in which he says, I used to love the Sony industrial design, where you slap black on it, and it feels heavy and industrial, black, black, black. But now that I've seen the Bauhaus style, which is, you know, the style of the 1930s out of Germany, Herbert Bayer and Gropius and Mies van der Rohe and others, I understand the virtue of simplicity, of keeping it clean. And simplicity is not something shallow, just a veneer where you eliminate things. Simplicity means you truly grok, you truly get the depth of the complexity that you have to overcome, and then you're able to make it simple. So that becomes the foundation of the Apple style.
And he talks about that again and again in different ways. And you find it to you, and you find him in the past talking about, oh, Michelangelo and Da Vinci were not just great artists, they were great scientists. And having these presentations where he says, we got to be at the intersection of Technology Street and Liberal Arts Street.
Right, exactly. And almost all the slides for the iPod at the end, I mean, his presentations end with a picture of the intersection of Liberal Arts Street and Technology Street. It comes from when he was really young and he met Edwin Land of Polaroid, back when Steve was first starting Apple. And Land says to him, the place to be is at the intersection of the humanities and technology. And I actually think that's, I hope, a lesson people can draw from the book, which is in the 21st century in this country, we've always had, you know, great technology and we've always had innovation. If we're going to be the preeminent, or any society is going to be a driving economy in the 21st century, it's going to be not just because you're good at science and math and technology, but you're good at connecting that to the arts and the humanities, creativity, design.
With artists like John Lasseter, like the
Johnny Ive, the great designer.
Exactly. The great designer he hired before that at Next to design just his logo, Paul Rand, paid him $100,000 for just a logo. It seems as though his contempt or tendency toward contempt didn't extend to artists. He cut them a lot more slack.
Yeah, as I said, there's that hero bozo divide in his life. You're either one or the other. And if you were an artist, he truly had this emotional, he would get tears in his eyes. And by artists, copywriters for the ads. If the copywriting was great, he would tear up and say, it's the best thing I've ever seen. And so, I hope in the book, when people see him berating people who do things bad, there is an equal number of him tearing up and saying, this is just the most beautiful ad copy, the most beautiful design of an iPod. This is the most beautiful movie.
Well, and there's a sense that they are authored. It isn't just a series of compromises to do it cheaply. It's there is an intelligence behind them.
The original Macintosh, after he's driving everybody insane for what he calls an insanely great product, and he's doing his reality distortion field, meaning we can have it out this January when they're saying, no, we can't. He calls them all together and he says, great artists, sign their work. I want you to sign. And they have a big, sheet that they all take Sharpies and sign, and it's engraved on the inside cover of the original Mac. Now, they made the original Mac with the type of fasteners that you couldn't even open up. There's no screws allowing you to open up the Mac. Nobody will see that. But he wanted to know that the 20, 30 members of the original Macintosh team were artists and that they should sign the inside of the case.
His perfectionism about design and his and the way he could be so contemptuous of bad design even extended to the medical devices he was
so
had
he's
to deal
lying
with.
There in Memphis, 2009, having had a liver transplant. They put an oxygen mask on him, or mask on him. I'm not sure it's just some sort of mask. And he's kind of groggy, and he's really, sedated. And he says, I hate the design of this. And he rips it off. And he orders them, the nurses and doctors, whatever, bring me 5 different options, because that's what he always loved to do in the design studio with Johnny Ive, is walk around and say, let's look at 5 options for how we could do the next iPad. And then there was a medical device they had to put on his finger to measure blood oxygen, I think it was. And he hated the design of it. So actually, in the past year, he had been working on how do you create a better design for a medical device like that.
That's amazing. I also realized reading this book, which is terrific, that in a way I hadn't before, that Steve Jobs is the kind of ultimate baby boomer in every respect, for better and for worse. This hippie who kind of monetized the countercultural sensibility to become a multi-billionaire. This adult who decided, no, I'm going to wear jeans and sneakers all the time. I don't care what you business guys think. This childlike think differentness and kind of love of his devices as toys, the way a child loves something on Christmas morning. Yet this terrible brat, too. He really is his generation in an incredibly vivid nutshell.
Absolutely. And what's particularly interesting, and it happens in Silicon Valley in the late 1960s and early 70s, is you have the great fusion of what becomes a baby boomer contradictions, which is on the one hand, drugs, rock and roll, dropping acid, listening to Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead and the Bay Area groups and that sort of whole earth catalog mentality. And also the startup technology, electronics geekiness that's part of the mentality back then, too. And this fusion happened, and Steve Jobs is the epitome of it, which is wanting to be ambitious, successful, business-like, but also wanting to do that 1984 ad, wanting to do those Think Different ads to reassert the fact that you're a rebel, a misfit. And he wrote the copy for the Think Different ads with a few other copywriters, but he kept inserting phrases. And it's, here's the crazy ones, the rebels, the misfits. And this is, he's writing not just about people who buy Apple products, but about himself. And I think it ends by saying something like, the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. It is not just a manifesto for the Macintosh, but for the baby boomers and, frankly, for him.
He, like the ultimate baby boomer that he is a lover of music, especially music that came out when he was young. And you, more than once, it seems, look at all the music on his various Apple devices, and he played at one point his favorite music for you, including Joni Mitchell's Little Green, which, if listeners don't know, I want to remind them of what that song sounds like.
Born with the moon in Cancer, choose her a name she will answer to. call her green, and the winters cannot fade her. Call her green for the children who've made her little green. Be a gypsy dancer.
So a lot of people have been moved by Joni Mitchell over the years, but why was that song so important to
you? Well, Little Green is actually about having a child and putting it up for adoption. And Steve was, of course, put up for adoption by his biological mother when he was born. And he played that a lot. I asked him at one point, you know, does he think a lot about having been put up for adoption now? This was near the end, near this recently. And we were playing that song in his living room because he had just gotten the iPad 2 and transferred all of his music. And he was complaining about iCloud not yet existing, so he couldn't sync it automatically. And he had to, you know, manually sync his new iPad 2. And he was playing that song. He said, no, you know, I think now more about legacy than about being adopted. But he loved Joni Mitchell, and of course he loved Joan Baez, who he actually went out with for a while.
I didn't realize that he had a relationship with his other hero, Bob Dylan's former girlfriend, Joan Baez, who was 14 years older than he. Speaking of Dylan, who was, again, as with the, you know, it's a plurality, if not a majority of baby boomers, was his absolute hero. His favorite Dylan song, you say, was One Too Many Mornings?
That's what he said. I actually also think that there are a couple of other songs he loved from Dylan. When he does the Macintosh, the original Macintosh, he quotes from Bob Dylan lyrics.
Good morning and welcome to Apple's 1984 annual shareholders meeting. I'd like to open the meeting with a part of an old poem, about a 20-year-old poem by Dylan. That's Bob Dylan. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pens, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changin'.
He knew that this wasn't going to be a hagiography. But it's one thing to theoretically say, yes, I want it, the unvarnished truth. This won't seem like a house job, authorized biography. But it's another thing to see it. He didn't read it, right, before he died.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If he'd read it, do you think he'd go? He would be angry?
Yeah, he said in our last meeting, you know, a couple months ago when I was at his house and he was ill, he said, there'll be parts of this book I won't like. And it was a little bit more of a question than just a statement. I laughed and said, yeah, you know, I'm sure of that. And he said, don't worry, I'm not going to read it when it comes out. I'll read it a year from now or so, if I'm, you know, still around. But he said it in a way that I'll read it a year from now. And it made me believe he was going to be around a year from now, which actually made me very happy because he had this way of infusing people around him with his belief, his optimism. And by the way, he had 7 years of miracles, so okay, he'll stay one lily pad ahead of the cancer again for another year. And so I really believe that. I was hoping, it was of course hoping, that he was going to be around when it came out, and I was braced for the fact that he'd be yelling at me about certain things, but I kind of relished it. Relishing in that sort of painful way you relish something that's going to be so interesting and so intense, but
yeah,
like also a little bit painful, like a roller coaster ride. I was, you know, bracing for the talks we would have afterward.
Walter Isaacson, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Kurt.
Oh, I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. I know I stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs is out now.
In my life, I love you more.
Coming up, the actress and comedian Sandra Bernhard on The Woman Who Drove Her Into Show Business. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louis. It's so nice to be back.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I want to let you know about a special event coming up. On Wednesday, November 9th, I'm hosting a live taping of Studio 360 in New York. Our guests will include the funny and brilliant writers Colson Whitehead and Cintra Wilson, and a surprise comedian from a land far, far away. That's Wednesday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. You can get tickets at studio360.org, and I hope to see you there. Every so often, we ask artists and performers about works of art that change their lives. Today, Sandra Bernhard. If you've ever seen Bernhard act or sing or talk, you can't really forget her. She's almost cartoonishly tough and irreverent, but also intensely sincere. Her breakout role came in 1983 when Martin Scorsese cast her as an obsessed fan who helps kidnap a talk show host in The King of Comedy.
Do you like these glasses? Crystal, beautiful. I bought them just for you. I don't know, there's something about them that reminds me of just the simplicity of them. But if you don't like them, if there's even an inkling, even a doubt in your mind.
Sandra Bernhard, in real life, had her own obsession with a famous performer, a non-pathological obsession. In 1963, she saw a touring production of Hello, Dolly, starring Carol Channing. Bernhard was 8 years old.
You know, and then we got to the theater and we sat in our seats and just like, you know, the electrifying atmosphere of the Fisher Theater was just overwhelming. And of course, then the band, you know, the orchestra strikes up, the overture, and you're ready to jump out of your skin. And then out walks this creature, Carol Channing, in full, you know, 1890s regalia with the head dress and the hat and the, you know, the corseted dress.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louis. It's so nice to be back home where I belong.
And I was just jumping out of my seat. I mean, I was near hysteria. She had this voice that, you know, was unparalleled by anybody else. It was very enchanting. I mean, that's, of course, what made her such a big star and separated her from the pack, was not only that she had this incredible smile that went from one side of her face to the next.
Swaying for the band's playing.
One of my old favorite songs from way back when. So
bridge
that gap, fellas.
Find me an empty lap.
Fellas, Dolly'll never go away again.
And all the waiters were, you know, dancing.
Hello, darling. Well, hello, darling. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You're looking swell.
Right from the get-go, I assumed that I should be a part of the cast. Why am I not on stage here playing one of the, at least one of the supporting roles? It was just the whole experience of being in the theater and being with people that I felt were my kindred spirits, you know, that I felt I was home and where I belonged with these bigger-than-life characters. So when I saw it, you know, actually come to life on a stage with, you know, with an orchestra and sets, I was like, okay, well, I could bump it up to that easily. Well, one of the first times I ever came to New York, I made this sort of strange bet with myself. I said, if you see Carol Channing on this trip, that means you're going to be successful in your career. So this was probably in the 70s. And I actually did see Carol Channing crossing 57th and Madison. She was walking in front of me. And it was total kismet. I didn't bother her at the time. I hadn't really made my mark yet.
Happy together.
unhappy together. Carol was a jumping off place for me. She definitely gave me that license to say, you can just go for broke. I always felt like it was, you know, not only my gift, but it was my responsibility, and still is when people come to see me, to take it all the way out there, like, you know, like Carol would. We're in and we're out of the money. Definitely think my performance in The King of Comedy when I played Masha.
Let's do something crazy tonight. Just get insane. I want to be crazy.
Who was
slightly
unhinged. Was, you know, a direct descendant of Carol's performance.
Carol, I'll have a good time. You can't get crazy. See,
this character was insane and had to really just go completely crazy.
Wouldn't you like to see me out of my head? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be fabulous?
And my, you know, exposure to Carol early on gave me the license to do it. And then I think the first time I actually met her is when she came backstage to see me perform and I was doing my show, I'm Still Here, Damn It, in 1997. And she came backstage, she was wearing all white, she let her hair go natural, she wasn't wearing wigs anymore, she looked amazing, fit as a fiddle. And she literally came back and took me into her arms and said, you are my spiritual granddaughter. So I knew that I had really, you know, come full circle to be, you know, blessed by Carol Channing.
Is there a play that altered your life, or a song, or a movie, or any other work of art? If so, we'd like to hear about it. Tell us your story at studio360.org. Michael Rayfield produced that piece. This year's National Book Award finalists were just announced. One surprise was that in the fiction category, all five books were by very young and or relatively unknown authors. One of those finalists is Salvage the Bones by a writer named Jessamyn Ward. It's her second novel, and both of them are set in the same fictional small town on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi that she calls Bois Sauvage. And this one takes place during the days leading up to and including Hurricane Katrina. Jessamyn Ward, welcome to Studio 360, and congratulations.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So Hurricane Katrina happened 6 years ago. When did you decide that you were going to write a novel about it?
It took me a few years to commit to writing about the hurricane. I think that the hurricane was so awful and so devastating that it actually silenced me for a while. So it wasn't until around like 2007 that I decided that I wanted to tackle the hurricane in fiction. And even then, when I began writing the novel, I didn't actually call the hurricane in the novel Hurricane Katrina until, say, like half, when I was halfway through the novel. And then I thought, this is stupid. I know which storm I'm writing about. Yeah. I should call it Hurricane Katrina.
And you at that moment were no longer living on the Gulf Coast. Describe how you came to be there during the hurricane.
So I was attending the University of Michigan, and I had just finished up my MFA program in fiction, but I was scheduled to return to Ann Arbor in late August to begin teaching. But because I'm always so homesick, I thought, well, you know, I'll just stay here, you know, until the last moment. Like, I'll stay here through the hurricane, and then I'll, you know, drive up to Michigan, because I totally underestimated the storm. And then we didn't know that it was a Category 5 until the night before it hit, you know, and it hit early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, I just didn't know what I was doing. I totally underestimated it.
And what was it like for you and your family as you experienced it?
It was terrifying. My mom lives in a trailer, you can never stay in trailers during a hurricane. So we spent the night at my grandmother's house. And then when we woke up at like 6, 7 a.m., the storm was there. And then all of a sudden, water was inside the house. And her house had never flooded before. And we'd been over there, you know, for like countless, you know, sort of hurricanes, lesser storms. Mm-hmm. And then the water rose very, very quickly. And the water rose so quickly that we were afraid that we would drown inside the house. And we didn't want to climb into the attic because we didn't want to climb into the attic and drown. So we had to leave the house during the middle of the storm. And a lot of our cars were washed away. So we got into our trucks that had escaped the flood. And we actually were trying to make it to the local church, but we weren't able to make it there. And so we actually sat in a field, a high field, for a large portion of the storm until the water receded enough so that we could drive a little further. But still then we couldn't get to the church. And some of us were rescued by some neighbors that had a boat. Some of us were able to make it in our trucks a little later, and we were taken in by a family for the duration, for the rest of the storm.
So it sounds just about as scary as the storm as that you fictionalized in Salvage the Bones.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
The heroine and narrator is a 15-year-old girl named Esh, who lives in this house of men. Her mother had died in childbirth a few years earlier, and is a serious reader. She mentions having just read As I Lay Dying. She refers a lot, recurringly, to Greek gods and goddesses, which is not, being this incredibly literate girl at 15 is not the character you would expect this poor girl in a small town in the Gulf Coast to be. Was that part of who she would be for you from the beginning?
When I I knew that she would be reading over the summer. Like, I knew that she read, because I figured that she read in order to not be so isolated, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew that she would do well in English classes, and she would take her assignments seriously, and she would do them during the summer. But then, as I wrote the novel, she surprised me with how much she identified with those characters from the myths and how she attached to the character of Medea, and saw something of that character in herself and how that troubled her. She saw something of herself in those myths. And was able to sort of refer to them to try to understand her existence, and try to make sense of what she was dealing with during that time.
Is Esh at 15 a little bit like you at 15, a lot like you at 15? How does she compare?
Because she was a reader, and because she was using books to escape. In that way, I think that she reflects me at 15. But then, and all the other, you know, in how promiscuous she is and how she sort of sees the world and navigates the world, I think that she's very much her own character. But I do think that her love of books is, there's a little bit of me in there at 15.
Well, you must have always been the smart kid in town, right?
I was always the smart kid. It's funny because, you know, when I graduated from high school, I was a smart kid who was applying to all these Ivy League
fancy
big
colleges,
schools. Yeah, fancy colleges to go to school. But like, I think back to even when I was in elementary school and I would get teased and kids would call me a bookworm. So that stigma of being the smart kid has been with me from the beginning.
You call this town Bois Sauvage, which means wild wood, which has a kind of mythological ring, as if these children, these teenagers, are living a kind of Lord of the Flies existence. Was that intentional, that there's a sort of fabulistic quality?
Originally, actually, the name Bois Sauvage, I took it from my first book. I'm writing about a fictionalized version of the place that I grew up, mm-hmm. which is named DeLille, right? Mm-hmm. But DeLille is the second name for the town. The first name for the town, before it was named for a French settler, it was called Wolftown. And so that's actually why I came up with the French name Bois Sauvage, because I think that one of the meanings for sauvage can actually be wolf.
Huh.
And so I wanted that name to sort of reflect the history of the town that I come from.
So you read a lot as a kid. But at what point did you decide, I really want to be a writer?
Honestly, it was after my brother died. I actually sort of graduated from high school in Mississippi, and then I attended college at Stanford University, which Stanford University is a great university, but because of my background, you know, I come from a poor black rural community. I was totally overwhelmed at Stanford, and I thought that I did not belong there. And that doubt regarding, you know, like my, you know, intelligence followed me throughout my time there. And so I didn't commit to being a writer while I was there because I thought I took like one fiction class. And I just thought that I wasn't good enough. And I never spoke in class. And, you know, I struggled the entire time. But it wasn't until I graduated from Stanford, and I still harbored that sort of secret dream of being a writer. And I graduated from Stanford, and then the year after I graduated from Stanford, during that year, that's when my younger brother died. He was 19. He was hit by a drunk driver. And that changed everything for me because, you know, he taught me an important lesson that it's so cliche, but, you know, we're not promised anything, and that we can die at any time, and that... And so, you know, I realized that, and I was sort of living with that loss every day and with that realization every day because I loved them and I missed them so much. And I thought, well, what could I do with my life that, you know, that if I did die in like a month or a year or tomorrow or whenever, that I would feel like that I'd lived a life worth living and I'd done something that makes me happy and that serves some purpose. And then I thought, writing. Like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a writer. And so, you know, like, I sort of went against my better judgment, you know, which told me that I should attempt to, you know, study for the LSAT and go to law school or or find a more practical profession. And I decided to commit to writing. And that's when I began applying to MFA programs.
Do you, living in Northern California and Ann Arbor, Michigan, do you miss the South? And if so, what do you miss about it?
I do miss the South. You know, while I was in those places, this is going to sound strange, but I miss the air. You know, it's very humid.
You talk about it. There's a lot of humidity in this book.
Yes, yes. And it's hot. And I found that when I was in the South, and I think it's partly because it's where I'm from, and I have a very large extended family in DeLille, and I have a community where, you know, everyone knows everyone, and everyone's been living there forever. And so I think that, you know, that I missed that, but that I sort of associated that close-knit, tight feeling with the feeling of humidity and heat, because when you're in that kind of humidity, it feels like the air is embracing you. It's so heavy and so thick. I mean, there's a lot that even as I love Mississippi, there's a lot that I dislike about Mississippi. There's much that I hate about Mississippi. But, you know, that's home. So.
Yeah. But you, on the other hand, you presumably wouldn't have become who you've become, a well-regarded novelist and the rest, had you not left, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Because it taught me... You know, being away from home, I think, helped me to commit to writing about it when I did. Partly maybe because I was sort of writing into that homesickness because I missed it so much and thinking so much about home and like my place there and if I could have a place there. It helped me see things more clearly, and it helped me sort of, I guess, like more easily embrace the love that I felt for that place and for those people.
Jessamine Ward, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Thank you for having me.
Salvage the Bones is a finalist in fiction for the National Book Award. Do you think, are you counting down the days until you find out if you win?
No. No. I mean, it's such an honor to be a finalist, and I never thought that this could happen for me. So I'm just trying to sort of relish that that feeling and not think about the fact that there's a possibility that I might win.
That's what movie stars always say. It's just an honor being nominated.
It is.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
You can hear Jessamine reading an excerpt from her new book, Salvage the Bones, at studio360.org. Coming up, the vampire craze is still going very strong, but it turns out that being a vampire isn't really that much fun.
They're hungry, they need blood. One way or another, they go find their way to get it.
An original Halloween story. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by PBS, presenting The Fabric of the Cosmos, a new Nova series with physicist and author Brian Greene, starts Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Last week on the show, we heard from people who are so into their work as scientists that they've tattooed symbols and equations on their bodies. So we asked, do you have a tattoo related to your profession?
My name is Chris Martin. I live in Arlington, Massachusetts, and I'm an outreach director at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University.
Chris has the image of a matryoshka, a Russian nesting doll, tattooed on her leg.
It's very colorful. It's, in a way, it's very traditional because it has the sort of the kerchief on the head and the little round body and the cutesy Cupid doll face.
And I'm glad you said cutesy because it may be the cutesiest tattoo I've ever seen in my life.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thanks.
And so what does it represent for you in your life?
I decided to go with the image of the matryoshka for several reasons. One, because of its obvious connection to Russian culture and my strong passion for and work in the field, and also because it sort of, for me, represents this idea that there's more on the inside than there is on the outside.
Yep.
And it actually resembles my daughter in a way because she's blonde and blue-eyed and cutesy.
It's interesting, though, when I think of Russianness and Russian writers, I think of Dostoevsky and various forms of grimness. This is the opposite.
Yeah, there's a lot of the dark side to Russia, but it's also a really fascinating and quirky and sometimes ridiculous place. And, you know, one of my favorite authors today is Gary Steingart, who's a Russian emigre who lives in the U.S., and he writes very satirical, very funny novels that sort of turn this idea of dark humor on its head a little bit. So I guess for me and my personality, too, I prefer to see the lighter side.
What do your colleagues in the Russian Studies Center think of this?
I think some of them think it's silly, but they're probably not big tattoo enthusiasts. And my boss jokingly said that you can't question my commitment, and I'll probably have to work here forever because of it. So she was actually pretty pleased.
Well, Chris Martin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chris Martin listens to our show in Boston, and you can see her tattoo as well as a fantastic slideshow of everybody else who wrote in at studio360.org. And if you've got an occupationally themed tattoo, I hope you'll add your own. Halloween is kind of an annual referendum on pop culture. This year, the hot costumes are zombies, Angry Birds, and Katy Perry. Who is so last year? Sarah Palin and Freddy Krueger, for starters. But it seems that one costume never goes away. Vampires. You can bet money that this coming Monday, the streets will be crawling with kids and teenagers and grown-ups wearing capes and fangs. TV shows like True Blood and Vampire Diaries are still going strong. The last of the Twilight movies comes out next month. But Studio 360's Eric Malinsky has found out that the vampire lifestyle isn't really as glamorous as we've all been led to think.
Joyce Rubenstein lives in Woodbridge, Connecticut. Last fall, her daughter Alicia passed away under suspicious circumstances. The Rubensteins held a funeral, and they observed the Jewish custom of sitting Shiva.
She showed up at the Shiva. I looked up and there she was in the doorway. And one of her friends who knew about her condition, he told her to get out and she was on her way, but she turned back and she went and snapped at him. I mean really snapped with her, bared her fangs and everything.
Alicia Rubenstein, eventually establish contact with the rest of her living family. Now her mother, Joyce, comes regularly to this blood bank at the Hospital of St. Raphael in New Haven.
And then I donate my blood for her exclusive use.
New Haven is one of six cities in the U.S. to sponsor a blood bank program specifically for the families of vampires.
This will only hurt for a second.
The families are allowed to accompany nurses as they deliver blood directly to their loved ones.
Oh, good. This space is right in front.
New Haven has plenty of spooky gothic mansions. But Alicia Rubenstein and over a dozen vampires are living at a hardware store called Grossman's Lumber that went out of business 20 years ago. It's now a safe house, guarded by police. The police let us inside a holding area. They won't allow us to go any further. Even they don't go beyond the double doors.
Officially, they stay in the safe house. Unofficially, I'm sure they get out.
Officer Gil Lopez does 5 night shifts here a week, but he's skeptical about the program, especially when the vampire population increases.
They're hungry. They need blood. One way or another, they go find their way to get it. There's little more than we are but hall monitors.
Alicia enters the room, looking skinny and pale.
How are you today?
Okay. I'm awake.
The nurse hands her blood, and her mother has a special surprise.
I figured you're sitting here all day with nothing to do.
The 4-volume Twilight series by Stephanie Meyer that Alicia didn't get a chance to take from her bedroom. But Alicia rolls her eyes. She's outgrown these fantasies.
It's nothing like the books. Thanks a lot for the books, Mom. Yeah,
it was also a really great
my fault to let me go to all those movies. Aren't they like rated R or something?
You begged me and said it's okay. It won't bother me. I'll be fine. And now look, you made the decision and now you have to live with it or unlive with it.
The safe house where Alicia lives was established in 1994. Inspired by the film Interview with the Vampire, a group of local vampires went public for the first time and lobbied the city of New Haven to create the program. Now Connecticut is facing a crippling budget deficit.
We don't have enough security now for the safe houses that we do have.
Again, Officer Gil Lopez.
They're monsters. Giving them more real estate that doesn't solve the problem. Hey, Francis.
Hi, Gil.
Francis O'Connor is 74 years old. She's here to see her best friend from high school, Trudy Minetti.
It was 1956, and
she is technically 74, but she looks 19. She hasn't changed her clothes in decades.
Well, look, it's a little strange. Mostly your friends grow old at the same rate that you do, and she's a witness to my youth. Who else remembers Sarno's, you know?
For the first few years, it was fine, because, I mean, you know, then she got married to this total Squaresville guy. And then I have to sit and listen to babies, and it's my kid did this, and my kid did that, and oh, let me tell
you. Yeah, but I want to tell you, I had to sneak out at night because my husband would have killed me if he had known what I was doing. He would have killed me.
Frances has been helping her friend since before the safe houses, back when Trudy was hiding in cemeteries.
Don't think it was easy.
No, I know.
To keep her eating, you know, drinking. We had to do that every day. Every day. Couldn't go on vacations. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. And I assume that you're not going to pass this on to anybody. I mean, who
would do it?
Yeah.
Who would do it? My kids certainly wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Somebody said that the dead should not be a burden on the living. What do you think about that?
She's not dead. She's alive. She's here.
You're sweet. That's very nice.
Yeah.
You were a good egg.
An older vampire like Trudy Minetti may scoff at the glamorous vampires depicted in Twilight or True Blood, but she does think the public's fascination with vampires will continue to endure, for one reason.
It's not ever going to be my name on a tombstone, you know, because that would be a drag. No one's going to come to visit. Eventually, no one even remembers you were there. So I got that beat. That's never going to be me.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
And happy Halloween, everybody. The actors in that story were Lydia Gladstone, Uma Nkrochi, Mike Smith Rivera, Gene Richards, and Nicole Grevy. Eric Molinsky wrote and directed. And that is it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I do hope you'll listen to our next one. And if you're going to be in New York City on the 9th of November, please come join us for a live show with Colson Whitehead, Cintra Wilson, and a surprise guest comedian. Details are at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogeson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
Thanks, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tego.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
We have the technology.
It seems rather ridiculous that we back up our computers, but as far as our mind and, you know, brain is concerned, we just leave it up to whatever happens.
Better. Stronger. Faster.
Upgrading the human body. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.